The Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So we can just sit here enjoying this moment. No expectations. Not waiting for anything to happen. Just be here. Silence. Birds. silence. Breath, body. Don't try anything. Don't try to concentrate. Just be here. Relaxed, happy, with a half smile born upon my lips, nothing to do, nothing to accomplish. No past, no future. No names, no identity, no issues. Let go, let go, let go. And then let go some more. We seek enlightenment when it's already right here. We seek a peaceful mind, and it's already right here. One can sit here relaxed, open, spacious, seeking nothing, wanting nothing, needing nothing. In this moment, what do we need to be happy? Is there anything missing? The woodpecker answers. He knows he's lacking nothing. He goes about his day, be this simple. The Zen master said, when hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. How did we make this in such a big deal? So many highways and byways. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. When the bell sounds, I put on my sandals and walk to the meditation hall. Could it be this simple? So retreat gives us an opportunity to discover simplicity of life. And the result is not that we're great meditators. The result is we are happy people. People who are at peace. People who have equanimity in their lives. People who are open-hearted. Please remember that's what this is about. This is not about technique or technology. Lots of people are selling meditative technology. But it's not about that, is it? Reminds me when I first met Thich Nhat Hanh in Paris in the mid-70s after practicing at a fairly rigorous Zen center for six years or so, and I was telling him quite proudly, how we sat every day, meditated two, three, 4 hours every day. We did these intensive 7 day sesshins, a retreat once a month. He listened. Then he asked me, well, all these fellow practitioners of yours at the Zen Center, are they happy people? he wanted to know, what are their relationships like? Do they have loving relationships? What is their family life like? It was like he was talking a different language at that time. Because I thought it's all about serious practice. Right. That's what it was about. We were serious practitioners. We didn't mess around. Went right to the heart of things, uncompromising. Wanted to know whether they were happy people. At the time, it seemed sort of an irrelevant question, but it was the right question. So, Vimalakirti, let us return. See what the gang is up to. That gang of 32,000. Remember, they're all up how many yojanas high in there. Oh, by the way, I gave out some bad information yesterday. And I want to stand corrected, so I don't. You know, there are special hells in the Buddhist cosmology for teachers who mislead their students. So just to out of pure self-interest of wanting to protect myself, let me correct. I said yesterday a kalpa, and I gave the thing about the tortoise, and actually it just struck me afterwards that's not, in Buddhist teaching, that's not the the metaphor. Kalpas are just, immeasurable long periods of time. The sort of way we would say eons, you know, eons of time. That's a kalpa. And actually it came to me that metaphor of the tortoise, and actually it's, by the way, do you remember it's in the ocean, the little tire is in the ocean, and it only comes up once every 100 years, the amount of time it would, you know, actually put its head through the. I forgot to tell you that it's a blind tortoise. Okay. So that's a point. But the more important thing is that metaphor is used in relationship to the preciousness of this human life. Okay. So it is said in the traditional teachings. Well, it's not. It is the precious life means not just simply having a human life. It's a. It's what is called a meeting together of various opportunities and junctures, which have to do with, on the one hand, being born into a human realm, being born into a situation. Where one has a healthy body, et cetera, being born at a time when in a world system where a Buddha has appeared, being born at a time in a world system where the Buddha's teaching is still alive, being born at a time when not only the Buddha's teaching alive, but there are still realized masters teaching. You see, so that's one whole stream. And then it's a personal stream that one has come into contact with the Buddha Dharma, one has come in contact with the teaching, one has come in contact with the teachers, and then even further that one has opportunity, the leisure, it is said. The leisure. Look at Michael back there. The leisure to hear it come up to the mountains of North Carolina, hear a Dharma talk on Vimalakirti in a relaxed way. Look, I mean, that is so rare. How rare is it? It is as rare as this blind tortoise, right, moving through the oceans. The rarity of its being able to put its head up is supposedly the rarity where it's all come together like this for us, right? Because most human beings do not have this, do they? Now, again, most human beings couldn't care less. Let's get that straight. If you told them, look what you missed, you know, you missed a 7-day silent retreat at Southern Dharma, they would look at you like you were crazy to think that it was something worthy of meeting. They're probably happy they missed it. This is from a certain, please understand, from a certain vantage point, viewpoint, that this is But I think those of us who are in the practice and appreciate it deeply and appreciate the teachings and the lineage and understand, again, how fortunate we are that we have come in contact with the teachings, et cetera, et cetera, but that we also have enough leisure, opportunity in our life, right? That we can take a week off. I mean, we could say most human beings, we were just talking about most human beings wouldn't be interested, but even those who are interested, many because of financial reasons, et cetera, et cetera, don't have the opportunity, other responsibilities. Or many people are born in areas of the world where there is, the teaching is not present at all. Right? There's no dharma. There's no path of liberation. Right? There's all kinds of folk beliefs and other kinds of belief systems out there, none of which are about the emancipation beyond comprehension. Right. There are many religions out there, many paths, animistic paths, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. How many paths teach the way of the bodhisattva as the real purpose of life? So, now this is very precious. Like the blind tortoise. That's how precious it is. And so therefore, in the teachings, when we meditate on the preciousness of human life and these coming together of these various opportunities and fortunate junctures in life, it is a reminder to us that even if kind of we've, like, you know, like at the carnival, you know, we throw those little things and try to get them around the Coke bottles and stuff. Not easy. And even though we just, by chance, it just landed right, it may not land again right. We don't know when, right? And so in the same way, we don't know whether we'll ever come back to Southern Dharma again. We don't know where our life is taking us. We don't know our health, our well-being, our financial situation, etc., how often we will have this opportunity. So contemplating this way helps us understand the preciousness of life and the preciousness of this opportunity we've been given. Therefore, we shouldn't waste it, should we? We shouldn't waste it. So, this is chapter 7 regarding living beings. At that time, Manjusri, great bodhisattva of wisdom, remember he was the original one sent. He was by the Buddha. He was the only bodhisattva who was willing to inquire a long time ago after Vimalakirti's health. So the drama is still continuing on in Vimalakirti's bedroom. And so at that time, Manjusri asked Vimalakirti, how does the bodhisattva regard living beings? A meaningful question. Right? Since, right, we are in a realm that is filled with living beings, right? We are actually, come to think of it, we are in a room where we might say this is a room filled with living beings. So we don't have to think about this abstractly. We can look around the room and say, Manjusri is asking Vimalakirti, you know, when I see these things, right, these living beings, how should I view them? Right? What is my view of them? Right? It's a good question, right? Since it is often in our interaction with living beings, in our interchanges with living beings, that what? That either a wonderful, pure land, like we heard described earlier, where the Buddha's teaching is constantly being manifested, where all beings have exalted discussions of Dharma. Everybody treats everybody with love and respect and only cares about meeting everybody else's needs, right? Or we could have a world where it's only the teachings that resolve, reverberate, are all teachings about me and my and self and anger and greed, right? We can have that kind of world, which is kind of our world, come to think of it. In Buddhism, this world is called the Saha world. This is samsara. This is the world where beings are spinning around in the world of duality, the world of delusion, and the world of self and others, and all the things that arise from that misperception. Right? So the question is, how do bodhisattvas who live in this world of ordinary beings, and as you know, there are how many? There are simply 6 billion of them running around. How do they regard them? How do they look at them? How do they view them? Right? And so this is a question that has to do with how we look at each other over these next days, how we look at people in our family, people related to, our significant others, our parents, our children, our friends, our neighbors, people we work with, people we see in the stores, people we read in the news, right? The whole deal, including perhaps ourselves. Each of us is a living being, too. Right? So Manjushri asks, how do we view these beings? Manjushri asks Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti replied, as a conjurer looks on the beings he conjures up, thus does the bodhisattva regard living beings. So that's his first statement. He'll go on to make more. But after this, he kind of lists a bunch of things, but his first sentence with a period is, as a conjurer looks on the beings he conjures up, thus does the bodhisattva regard living beings. So the conjurer is the one who what? Creates these phantom figures, conjures up, right? And the conjurer, he says, as the conjurer. So the conjurer knows, right, since he conjured them, he knows they're what? They're not real. They're not real in what way? They're not real in any permanent, solid, self-existent way. Right? The three marks of existence. They appear. Look around at these living beings. They appear solid, don't they? Look at them, appearing in their solidity. And yet, we could take them apart, can't we? Can't we? And we have some physicians in the room who perhaps have done autopsies, and so they may be willing to demonstrate that which appears solid is just made up of parts. Right? Contained within a bag of skin. Right? As well as everything, every living being here that appears, we look at them and we think, oh, they're here. Right? And we look at them and they appear as they are, but we also don't see that they are what? Impermanent. They're changing. Right? Everybody here is changing and is subject to change, subject to causes and conditions. Right? So even though everybody looks solid and permanent, that is not the truth, is it? There's no solidity here and there's no permanence here. Right? As well as we go around going, Roberta, Andrew, right? And we think there's like somebody, like a thing, a self that everybody has, right? But upon investigation, no self can be found in anything and anyone. No self-existent thing exists. So also we could say that our minds conjure up permanent, solid, self-existent beings. Right? But the only difference between us and the conjurer is what? The conjurer knows that even though he's created this appearance, and can maybe play in the world of these conjured apparitions. The conjurer knows what? That he's created them all. She's created them all. They don't exist in any solid, real, permanent, self-existent way, right? Just like all of us. All of us have conjured up, right? I've conjured up something called Fred. Right, Charlie over there, he's conjured up something called Charlie, right? Darlene back there has conjured up something called Darlene, and she's conjured up something she calls Charlie, and thinks all these things are real, permanent, solid things. And then we're dismayed or frustrated that they don't, or saddened when they don't stay permanent or solid. Because we don't realize that what we've conjured up, is just our own projection of our own mind. It's not real. So the Buddha says, or Vimalakirti says, as a conjurer looks on beings he conjures up, she conjures up. Right? Now a conjurer, please understand, has what? A good conjurer, I don't know if there are any good conjurers in the room, you know, or if you know any good conjurers, but a good conjurer can do what? They can create these kind of phantoms, right? And then they can kind of have them, they can have tea parties with them, they can have them wash the dishes, you know, they can do all kinds of things with the things they conjure up. But they know what? That they're not real, not solid, not perfect. And just really apparitions of their own mind creation. Thus that the Bodhisattva regard living beings. And then Vimalakirti goes on to say, as the wise view the moon in the water, or face or form seen in a mirror. Right? So we see, we look in the water, and we see the moon, right? But is that moon that we see in the water, is that a solid moon, real moon? No, it's just a reflection. Reflected in the water. Or a face or form seen in a mirror. Where does that face appear? In the mirror. Where, as we look around the room, do all these living beings appear? In our awareness. That's all. You're appearing in my awareness, I'm appearing in your awareness. Like the moon in the water. Right? Like a reflection in the mirror. Right? If you look at a mirror, the mirror just reflects back exactly what appears in it, right? That's all it does. It just simply reflects what appears in front of it. It doesn't judge. It doesn't comment. It doesn't care. It doesn't evaluate. It doesn't create stories about. Does it? It just reflects. See, we create all these ghosts, see, because we have lots of opinions and thoughts and stories about everybody we encounter, especially ourselves. And we think that's real. But we've just conjured it up with our own thoughts and that's all. We just made the whole thing up. We think it's real. It doesn't mean they don't exist. It doesn't mean that conjurers, conjurations, what's a conjurer looks at the beings he conjures up. Is there a name for them? I guess apparition? I don't know. Anyhow, he knows, so he can play with them. He knows he made them up, and he can change their forms, and, you know. Right? So he conjures up useful things. But he always knows they're all his or her creation. We don't know that. We think our thoughts and our feelings are real. Right? Our opinions, our judgments about everybody else and about ourselves, you know, all the stories we tell, we think they're real, don't we? How real is a thought? How real is a thought? How real is a judgment? I can say, I'm a complete idiot. I could say, I'm a genius. Right? I could say, I'm the tallest man in the world. I could say, I'm the shortest man in the world. Just words and thoughts. Right now, I could say, I had the best childhood that anybody in the world's ever had. Right? And I could create up a whole story of my wonderful childhood, and I'll be what? Happy. Right? I feel great. Or I could say, I had the worst childhood of anybody in the whole world. Couldn't I say that? And I could create up a whole story about that and be unhappy, couldn't I? This mind can do anything. Right? And whatever, either story or any variation in between is all my own creation. Now that's hard to accept. But it's true. Because our mind is just a mirror. It doesn't evaluate anything. It just reflects. Just reflects. It's called awareness. It's called Buddha mind. It's called many things. It's called nothing. And in our practice, slowly, through the cultivation of mindfulness, concentration, insight, selflessness, compassion, understanding, right? We uncover. We clean. Now our mirror is covered with dirt, covered with dust, so it doesn't reflect, it distorts. But through practice, we cleanse it. clean it so it can shine with its original clarity. There are probably many people in here who are probably saying, whatever, you know, however long you've been practice, I am seeing more clearly than I used to see. My view is not as distorted as it used to be. That's good. As a conjurer looks on the beings, he conjures up, thus the bodhisattva regards living beings. And then goes on to say, as the wise view the moon in the water, or the face or form seen in the mirror, as shimmers of heat in a torrid season, as the echo that follows a cry, as clouds in the sky, foam on the water, bubbles on the water, a thing no firmer than the trunk of the plantain, no longer lasting than a flash of lightning. As a fifth grade element, a sixth component, a seventh sense meter, a 13th sense meter, a 19th sense realm, thus the bodhisattva regards living beings. These all mean that they don't exist in any solid, permanent, real way. So please look around the room. These are what we're talking about. So when you look, just look. And don't view what you're seeing as some permanent, solid thing imbued with a self. Because none of that exists in that way. They're just here. And they're in process. And if you could peel them off their skin, you'd find thousands and thousands of parts, no self to be found. And if you took their mind apart, you just see thoughts coming and going, thoughts coming and going, thoughts coming and going, feelings, perceptions coming and going, and behind it all, and it's all arising in awareness, consciousness, and that's it. Now, that could be greatly disappointing for some people. But you know what, my friends? It can be very liberating. Oh. So that's what's going on here. Right? Things aren't so solid, serious, permanent, heavy. Because this is a universe where things are just in flux. Right? That's all. Nothing solid. Right? Nothing permanent. Nothing we can rely on but what? Buddha Dharma Sangha. Sound like a cultist, don't I? What can we rely on in this life? Understanding, compassion, mindfulness, how we relate to phenomena, enlightened view. In terms of everything else, it's all just coming and going, changing, being born, dying. And yet in this moment, nice breeze from the fan, birds are singing. Just this. And then he goes on to say, as forms in the formlessness, in the world of formlessness, as sprouts from charred grain, as mistaken views of the body of one who's entered the stream that leads to the earth. He goes on and on. I mean, they're very interesting, each of them. Forms seen by a blind person, as the breathing in and out of one immersed in the samadhi of utter tranquility. Because when one's in the samadhi of utter tranquility, there's almost no breathing at all. So it's all these things that don't exist. The tracks of birds in the sky. Anybody notice lots of tracks birds leave when they go through the sky? No. So he's going on and on with these just to kind of you get it. Right? It's like this, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. He's trying to let us, give us another view. Right? In Zen there's a wonderful phrase that we're you know, about how to live or how to move through life. It says, leave no trace. Right? Leave no trace. Everything clean, every act pure. Leave no trace. Right. When you come into your, you know, so like you come in to the meditation hall, you walk, you take your seat, you sit, and when you get up, you clean it off, you pluff it up, as if no one has been there, no trace. Right? Like that. No trace. You live your life that way. Most people, they want to leave a big trace, right? I want to be remembered for this, and I want to be thought about for that. I want everybody to know that I'm here, right? And when I'm gone, this is what I want to be remembered for. And then people think this way. I mean, they're still alive, and they're already planning, thinking about how they want to be remembered. I mean, why would you care? You're gone. You know, you're never going to know. But people obsess about this. Right? Remember me any way you want. It's your memory. Leave no trace. It's a wonderful little phrase. I invite you to, ego wants to leave its trace everywhere, doesn't it? It wants to put its mark on everything. Please notice me. Hey, anybody notice what a good job I did today? Right? There may be egos in all of us going. I mean, we'll come up to a place like this and we'll just mess around in the weeds and all of a sudden we'll want to be noticed. Please, anybody notice me? I did that. Hey, look, I did that. We're always just leaving our trace. We want to be noticed. But there's a burden in that. Can you see it? Can you see the burden in that? I mean, we laugh, but there's a burden because it means that the way I feel about myself, or it's all related on being noticed and how I'm noticed and noticed in a certain way. And when you're in that, it only leads to suffering. This teaching, they notice us, fine. They don't notice us, fine. Equanimity, right? It's a wonderful place to be, isn't it? Right? Some places you go and you're the center of attraction. Oh, it's Jun. Everybody knows Jun, everybody's happy to see her, right? Other places she goes, nobody knows her. Completely ignored. You know, can we be equanimous in both? Right? Just causes and conditions. Right? Some places we're noticed, some places we're not noticed. Right? Leave no trace. As the tracks of a bird in the sky. As sights in a dream after one has wakened. Right? That's a good one. That's our whole past. All the things we've done. Just a dream, isn't it? Last night, you might have dreamt. There might have been all kinds of characters in your dreams, right? All kinds of people. I mean, dreams are incredible, right? They can be people you don't know you can bring into your dream. You can bring famous people into your dream. Presidents, celebrities, right? You can bring them all. do all kinds of things, go all kinds of places, right? Just have a wonderful time, or have a terrible time, have brilliant dialogues. But when you wake up in the morning, what do you know? It's gone. Just a dream. That's really, everything's like that. Because the only thing we have that is solid is this moment. And yet we know, like the conjurer, that even this moment, there's nothing here of any solidity, permanence. So please, over these next days, as you encounter living beings, as you will, since we are in a group here, we're not on solitary practice off by ourselves, please begin to view them in this way. Everybody, even the ones you're close to. Very important. So then, you know, when they change, you know, you're not floored. You're not surprised. You're not ambushed. You're not distraught. You're not anything like that. Because you know already what? This is the nature of phenomena. Right? This is the nature of dream. Now, this is very important, what happens next. I don't think we're going to get to the goddess who lives. Well, I'd like to do it all in one, you know what I mean? And it's getting... Maybe I'm just making it up, just kind of leading you on so you'll show up the next day. You know, I'm afraid no one will show up, so I got to keep telling you this is... There's this goddess who's been in McCurdy's room for 12 years, and she gets into a whole thing with Shariputra, and everybody goes, that sounds racy. I think I'll show up for that one. No, but this cannot be skipped. So, and somebody wrote me a note about asking a question related to this a couple of days ago. But up to now, we've been, especially in this, right? So this is very important now. So here we get, you know, everything's a dream. Living beings, they're what? Right? Just like apparitions. Nothing solid, nothing permanent. Right? So then Manjushri asks this, which is the obvious question. If the bodhisattva looks on beings in this way, how can he or she treat them with compassion? This is a very core, right? Because what we've just been on in this earlier part of the chapter is on the wisdom side of Dharma, right? How things really are, how things really appear, what's really the truth of reality, right? Well, one might say, well, if it's all a dream, if everything is a reflection, if everything is impermanent changing, then why not? Then just, you know, let it unfold, right? You know, somebody gets hit by a car, just let them lay there, right? Eventually they'll decompose. right? You know what I mean? You know, somebody's in trouble, you know, that's their own, you know, that's the unfolding, there's nothing real there, right? You know, you encounter somebody suffering physically, emotionally, yourself, you know, why care, right? It's just a dream. You see what I'm saying? So you can see that if we're not careful, we can go into that place of, you know, a kind of deep understanding that produces indifference, right? Indifference. You know why? You know why? You know. Just let them go through their grief or their depression or their anxiety. I mean, why? Right? Or their fear. I mean, why help them? Right? It's all. It's not really real. They're just deluded. And maybe one day they'll wake up and see it for themselves. Right? But at this point, I'm enjoying the calls of the birds and the breezes of the, right? Sounds of the, why be compassionate? And compassion in Buddhism is very interesting. I mean, compassion in Buddhism involves, compassion is not just empathy. It's important to understand that. The word karuna, which is a Sanskrit word for compassion, doesn't just mean an empathic human being, somebody who feels the suffering of another. Right? It also involves actively wanting to help and helping. It's important. Right? So to be a compassionate person in Buddhism doesn't just mean I feel your pain. I feel your suffering. And a lot of people are empathic people. But if in the terms of what karuna means, we wouldn't call them compassionate people. This is important because to understand that karuna, one of the four immeasurables, is active. Right? There's no separation. Right? That the capacity to experience the suffering of another is the same as a natural desire to relieve it. There's no separation. This is very important. Okay. It is the same way, think of yourself. That's the best example, right? If you bang your elbow and it hurts, you just naturally what? Reach over. It's a natural, right? To give it relief. Right? You don't stop and think. It's just an elbow. Right? I mean, this elbow's okay. Right? It's not. Can you see what I'm saying? It's not an evaluative process. We don't kind of go through. You know, what else am I doing? Right? You know what I mean? Think about it. When we are hurting, when we are in pain, right? It's just naturally we want to do something about it, right? Right. So I mean, Andrew's over there. When his nose gets full, he just naturally what? I mean, can you imagine what it'd be like if your nose was on its own? Right. It relies on your hands, doesn't it? And your hands don't go, sorry, I'm busy. Right? I'm not all stuffed up. I mean, I'm fine. Right? You see, there's a connection. Right? Right? And when the nose is stuffed up, even though the hands are not, there's a connection. All beings, one body. And so very compassionately, your hands reach for the tissue and bring it up so your poor nose can empty itself of mucus. Right? It's an act of compassion. Right? You know, I mean, the hands aren't just down there going, oh, poor Andrew with his stuffed nose. poor guy is probably just miserable. You know? How would that be? If their hands were just like that. See, there they go. Look at that. This is a demonstration of a living demonstration of Buddhist compassion. There it goes. No separation, right? Because the hand and the nose are connected, right? So they naturally work to relieve one another. That's compassion. So if the Bodhisattva looks on being this way, you know, how can you treat them with compassion, Manjushri? And Vimalakirti replies, when the Bodhisattva has finished regarding them in this way, okay, remember how we just regarded them, she or he thinks to themselves, for the sake of living beings, I must preach this Dharma to them. This is true compassion. For the sake of living beings, I must preach this Dharma to them. This is how one thinks. This is true compassion. So the Bodhisattva has this view, right? And yet sentient beings, living beings, don't. They're caught up, aren't they? They believe that things are permanent. They believe things are solid. They believe things are imbued with self. Right? So they suffer. Not only do they create this world of suffering for themselves and others, but they don't know how to stop it. They don't know how to change it. They don't know how to get out of it. Many of them don't even know they're suffering. They think this is normal. Right. So it's because the Bodhisattva sees so clearly the way things are. And it sees so clearly that all the living beings they're living with don't and therefore are suffering for no reason other than what they've created for themselves. The Bodhisattva, for their benefit, I will teach them the Dharma. This is true compassion. In other words, I will what? I will help them. I will help. And then he goes on for a couple of pages talking about the compassion. And again, it's... I don't know if we need to go through all this, but I'll just read some of them. He treats them with a compassion on burning. Right. So it's not a compassion that has a lot of emotionality. It's not burning. Right. It's very clear, very cool, very kind, but there's not a lot of emotionality. It's not burning. There's not a lot of angst. There's not a lot of drama in the way a Bodhisattva helps a sentient being. It treats him with compassion and burning for his void of earthly desires. Right? when we have earthly desires, we want something, don't we? So the compassion of a bodhisattva is not burning with a desire. You know, if I said, is your hand burning with a desire to help your nose out? And you'd say, no. It's just a very simple, natural. Right? If I said to you, Andrew, the fact that your nose fills up with mucus 10 minutes, and once again, your hand has to reach into the pocket, pull out that already used, and, you know, and put it up to your nose. I mean, is your hand disappointed that it has to do it again? No. Isn't that hand wonderful? It's showing us that it acts compassionately, but it has no earthly desire. It's not asking to be noticed. It's not making a big deal about it, is it? It's not saying to Andrew, well, now that I've done this good thing for you, will you take care of me or get me something special today? Right? You know? Or, you know, Andrew's not holding up his hand in the Sangha going, look what a compassionate hand I am. Look. All day, selflessly, it's been blowing a nose, which has nothing to do with it at all. Right? Show and tell, hold up your hand. What a marvelous, compassionate hand you have.
Right. I have washed it a lot.
Really? You know how you've washed it? With the help of this hand. It couldn't do it by itself, could it? So you have a compassionate left hand too, Andrew. That even though it hasn't been the one holding up the snot rag to the nose, it is willing to help for hygiene's sake. Very wonderful. I mean, and don't forget forearm and elbow, all have been, right? I mean, because if you didn't have your elbow, kind of hard, you know, to blow your nose, so don't forget your elbow. Very kind. Right? So much to be grateful for. The little thing. Treats him with a compassion that is impartial, with a compassion free of contention. Treats him with a compassion undualistic. You see, there's no dualism. Right? The hand doesn't see itself as separate from the nose. It just naturally, no separation. It understands. It's all my body. It's all one body. No separation. A compassion that's unfaltering, for it carries through to the end. Treats him with a compassion firm and durable, for the mind of the bodhisattva never flags. Because the mind of a bodhisattva is not bound by space and time, not bound by self, not bound by duality, right? It's open. Ceaseless. Right? It's not on duty and off duty. Right? Did your hand go, I'm off duty? Right? Mm-mm. I'm only available between the hours of right? I need my rest too. Doesn't get annoyed. Oh my God, there it goes. You never realize what a wonderful hand you have. The hand that never flags. You have it. The hand that whose compassion is unfaltering, that hand of yours. Right? Until it probably is so infirm that it cannot move, it rich itself. It will be helping your nose out. You know, almost to death. Your hand will be there for you. Unfaltering like that. Never complaining. Never tiring. Right? Even when you wake it up at night, it was sleeping so soundly. Get up. Time to blow the nose again. It doesn't, right? It doesn't give you grief, does it? But that's what you're saying. This hand is not saying that, is it? Isn't that wonderful? It's saying, as long as you need me, I'll be there for you. This hand says to the nose. Right, like that. Treats them with a compassion boundless. Boundless as the empty sky. Treats him with the compassion of the arhat. The arhat is, you know, in so-called Hinayana Buddhism, the arhat is the ideal. But the arhat, again, is this being who's cut off all desire, cut off all attachments, has renounced everything. So this is, but the arhat has compassion because... treats him with the compassion of an arhat who has conquered the thieves of desire, treats him with the compassion of the bodhisattva who brings contentment to all being, treats him with the compassion of the thus come one, the Buddha, who has grasped the marks of suchness, treats him with the compassion of the Buddha who awakens living beings, treats him with a compassion wholly natural, understanding that it is causeless. Just the same way. The hand just reaches. Treats him with the compassion that has no gradation, for it cuts off all favoritism. Right? That's a big one for us, isn't it? We want to be compassionate to some people, but there's all kinds of people we don't want to be compassionate to, right? We play favorites. Bodhisattvas don't play favorites because they see all living beings, good ones, bad ones, high ones, low ones, Republicans, Democrats, progressive, Tea Party. They see all living beings as what? As a conjurer sees its apparition. Moon in the water, as bubbles, as the echo of sound, cuts off all favoritism, treats them with great compassion, great loving kindness, guiding them with the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Treats them with a compassion that never despairs. Seeing that all is empty without ego. Treats him with the compassion of the bestowal of the law, never stinting in its gifts. Treats him with the compassion of observance of the precepts, training those who break them to do better. Treating him with the compassion of forbearance, patience. And these are the paramitas, the compassion of assiduousness, shouldering all beings as its burden, etc. This is interesting. Treats them with a compassion that hides nothing, proceeding with the purity of an upright mind. I wonder what that means. Him with the compassion that hides nothing. What do you think it is that in a compassionate action we might hide?
Our ulterior motives.
Could be. But if we're hiding nothing, we have no ulterior motives. Maybe it means we're willing to show how much we care. We're not afraid to hide that. You know, how much we want them to be better, happier, freer, free of suffering. Treats him with a compassion that is unerring, innocent of falsity and sham. So we see, with Andrew's hand, there's no falsity or sham. There's great purity. It has no ulterior motive. It's not asking for anything for itself, is it, your hand? Right? It's not asking to be noticed. It's not asking to be called compassionate hand. Right? Upright hand, wonderful hand, helpful hand. It's not asking for anything. There's no ulterior motive in that hand. It just helps in any way it can. And these hands are wonderful, right? Because now it's helping you by what? By holding the rag, the handkerchief up to your nose, right? But what? Walking later, it can do this. Look at that. Isn't that incredible? You know? The gnats aren't bothering the hand at all. It's down there quite peaceful. But all of a sudden, what? It's on duty. Does it complain? It doesn't go, hold on. You had me blowing your nose for the last 2 hours up in the meditation hall, right? Now, you're walking around and you got me getting rid of gnats away from your eyes. Give me a break. Can't your eyes take care of themselves? Right? That's the way we are, aren't we? Hey, come on. Didn't I already do this? Now you're asking me to do that? Right? We should learn from our hands. Right? If you had an itch, now it's on duty scratching. Go back to your room, you want to wash, now it's on duty washing. Go into the shower, you got it working again. Taking care of all these other parts of the body. Right? It doesn't go, I just want to wash myself today. That's all. Well, I got to wash all these other body parts. They're not me. That's the way we are. Separate selves, only thinking to take care of ourselves. We should learn from our hands, much more developed than our heads. Freely, taking care of, doing whatever is needed. Such as treats him with a compassion full of peace and delight. For through it they gain the delight of the Buddha. Such is the compassion of the Bodhisattva. So we'll end here. Quite wonderful. Right? This this dialogue between Manjushri and Vimalakirti, showing us how wisdom and compassion work together. So this is a profound teaching, meaningful teaching. We can all do better, can't we?